Science went abroad from its first home like an unloved child. The splendid chemical industry of Germany was built on the work of the Englishman, Sir William Perkin, who could find no practical English businessman to back him. And Germany also led the way in many forms of social legislation. Germany realized that labor is a national asset, that it deteriorates through unemployment, and that for the common good it has to be taken care of outside the works. The British employer was still under the delusion that labor had no business to exist outside the works, and that the worse such exterior existence was, the better somehow for him. Moreover, because of his general illiteracy, he was an intense individualist. His was the insensate rivalry of the vulgar mind. He hated his fellow manufacturers about as much as he hated his labor and his customers. German producers, on the other hand, were persuaded of the great advantages of combination and civility. Their enterprises tended to flow together and assume more and more the character of national undertakings. This educating, scientific and organizing Germany was the natural development of the liberal Germany of 1848. It had its roots far back in the recuperative effort that drew its impulse from the shame of the Napoleonic conquest. All that was good, all that was great in this modern Germany, she owed indeed to her schoolmasters. But this scientific organizing spirit was only one of the two factors that made up the new German Empire. The other factor was the Hohenzollern monarchy, which had survived Jena, which had tricked and bested the revolution of 1848, and which, under the guidance of Bismarck, had now clambered to the legal headship of all Germany outside Austria. Except the Tsardom, no other European state had so preserved the tradition of the grand monarchy of the 18th century as the Prussian. Through the tradition of Frederick the Great, Machiavelli now reigned in Germany. In the head of this fine new modern state, therefore, there sat no fine modern brain to guide it to a world predominance in world service, but an old spider lusting for power. Prussianized Germany was at once the newest and the most antiquated thing in Western Europe. She was the best and the wickedest state of her time. The psychology of nations is still but a rudimentary science. Psychologists have scarcely begun to study the citizen side of the individual man, but it's of the utmost importance to our subject that the student of universal history should give some thought to the mental growth of the generations of Germans educated since the victories of 1871. They were naturally inflated by their sweeping, unqualified successes in war and by their rapid progress from comparative poverty to wealth. It would have been more than human in them if they hadn't given way to some excesses of patriotic vanity. But this reaction was deliberately seized upon and fostered and developed by a systematic exploitation and control of school and college, literature and press, in the interests of the Hohenzollern dynasty. A teacher, a professor, who didn't teach and preach in and out of season, the racial, moral, intellectual, and physical superiority of the Germans to all other peoples, their extraordinary devotion to war and their dynasty, and their inevitable destiny under that dynasty to lead the world, was a marked man, doomed to failure and obscurity. German historical teaching became an immense systematic falsification of the human past, with a view to the Hohenzollern future. All other nations were represented as incompetent and decadent. The Prussians were the leaders and regenerators of mankind. The young German read this in his schoolbooks, heard it in church, found it in his literature, and it poured into him with passionate conviction by his professor. It was poured into him by all his professors. lecturers in biology or mathematics would break off from their proper subject to indulge in long passages of patriotic rant. Only minds of extraordinary toughness and originality could resist such a torrent of suggestion. Insensibly, there was built up in the German mind a conception of Germany and its emperor as of something splendid and predominant as nothing else had ever been before, a godlike nation in shining armor, brandishing the good German sword in a world of inferior and very badly disposed peoples. We've told our story of Europe. The reader may judge whether the glitter of the German sword is exceptionally blinding. Germania was deliberately intoxicated. She was systematically kept drunk with this sort of patriotic rhetoric. It's the greatest of the Hohenzollern crimes that the crown constantly and persistently tampered with education, and particularly with historical teaching. No other modern state has so sinned against education. The oligarchy of the crowned Republic of Great Britain may have crippled and starved education, but the Hohenzollern monarchy corrupted and prostituted it. It can't be too clearly stated, it's the most important fact in the history of the last half century, that the German people was methodically indoctrinated with the idea of a German world predominance based on might, and with the theory that war was a necessary thing in life. The key to German historical teaching is to be found in Count Moltke's dictum, "Perpetual peace is a dream, and it isn't even a beautiful dream. War is an element in the order of the world ordained by God. Without war, the world would stagnate and lose itself in materialism." And the anti-Christian German philosopher Nietzsche found himself quite at one with the pious field marshal. "It's mere illusion and pretty sentiment," he observes, "to expect much, even anything at all, from mankind if it forgets how to make war. As yet no means are known which call so much into action as a great war, that rough energy born of the camp, that deep impersonality born of hatred, that conscience born of murder and cold-bloodedness, that fervor born of effort in the annihilation of the enemy, that proud indifference to loss, to one's own existence, to that of one's fellows, that earthquake-like soul-shaking which a people needs when it's losing its vitality." This sort of teaching, which pervaded the German Empire from end to end, was bound to be noted abroad, bound to alarm every other power and people in the world, bound to provoke an anti-German confederation, and it was accompanied by a parade of military and presently of naval preparation that threatened France, Russia, and Britain alike. It affected the thoughts, the manners, and morals of the entire German people. After 1871, the German abroad thrust out his chest and raised his voice. He threw a sort of trampling quality even into the operations of commerce. His machinery came on the markets of the world. His shipping took the seas with a splash of patriotic challenge. His very merits he used as a means of offence, and probably most other peoples, if they had had the same experiences and undergone the same training, would have behaved in a similar manner. By one of those accidents in history that personify and precipitate catastrophes, the ruler of Germany, the Emperor William II, embodied the new education of his people and the Hohenzollern tradition in the completest form. He came to the throne in 1888, at the age of 29. His father, Frederick III, had succeeded his grandfather, William I, in the March, to die in the June of that year. William II was the grandson of Queen Victoria on his mother's side, but his temperament showed no traces of the liberal German tradition that distinguished the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family.